Welcome to the Better Call Saul edition of the Serious TV Drama Podcast with Scott and Dan. I'm Scott, and with me as always, the merry wanderer to my Bavarian boy, it's Dan. How are you doing this
evening? Good
evening.
I'm good. But I was kind of hoping you'd refer to yourself as Colonel Ty now that you're walking around with an eye patch.
No one knows what we're talking about. You know, an eye patch might not look too bad on me. So
no, you could pull it off. You'd look like when like O'Brien is playing the Falcon in that James Bond Deep Space Nine episode. I think that's how.
Leave it to you.
That didn't take long.
Leave it to you to make a Star Trek reference that fast, and also references would be like what? Just so the kids out there know what you're talking about. Yeah, I've developed this little weird. Pretty much determined some sort of sty under my left eye, which leaves it just, it's not like horrific looking. I mean, it's one of those things that one might not even notice unless they're looking for it, but it's like having like the tiniest little swelling black eye kind of thing going on. Like I got into a fight with a very small person or something.
My son had one last week. It went away pretty quick.
Yeah. I'm waiting for it to go away. One of those things where if it still is bothering me to the same extent by Friday, I might actually seek medical attention. But right now, I'm just hoping it'll just go away with the occasional warm compress and such. Hence the eye patch joke.
Yes.
I heard that a couple times when I was out the other night as well.
Nice.
Someone was saying that they were going to crochet me an eye patch. I was like, all right.
It'd be cool to have just as a memento of, I don't know, like your eye being messed up for 3 days once.
Yes. I like to keep mementos of all my minor injuries as I get older. But we are not here to talk about eye patches. We are here to talk about the latest episode of Better Call Saul. So I guess without any further bantering or ado or whatever, let's just get down to it and talk about Better Call Saul. Now, this latest episode of Better Call Saul was titled Something Beautiful. And I will say right now that I forgot to take a look at who wrote and directed the episode. I'm actually looking that up as I stall.
I definitely would say that it was a good title for the episode, because the cinematography on it was really top-notch, especially in the opening scene. Man, the thing was, that was some pretty sharp desert stuff going on there.
Right. Well, the director, am I familiar with this director? The director's name is Daniel Sackheim.
Sackheim has been doing stuff for like ever, on like every show imaginable.
Yep, you're right. I'm looking at his resume right now, and he literally has a handful of episodes of like every other pretty good to really good show. From The Americans to Game of Thrones to Man the High Castle to The Leftovers and Ozark and Better Call Saul and Southland, Longmire, as you always like to mention.
Longmire.
Yeah. Dude's got a bunch of shows under his belt, and apparently he's slated to direct the third episode of the third season of True Detective, too, so I know that'll excite you. So that was the director, and the writer we are familiar with, the main writer for this episode was Gordon Smith, who has turned in some of the more memorable episodes, if I recall, of Better Call Saul. And of course, I do.
Yep. And very true.
So, you know, that's it for the credits. Let's get to the show. Yeah, the opening. What I love about the opening, other than the fact that once again it's, you know, in the tradition of both Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, it's beautifully shot. You know, the way that the shots are put together. You know, it's not just pure cinematography, but things that just look pretty. It's the mise-en-scène and how, you know, things are in the frame and whatever. But and that's a tradition that carries on from Breaking Bad and to this show. And another thing, which has, I would say, has become a trope of both television series, is that they like to, every once in a while, they like to take their time and just show us the process of a plan, something being executed, being put together, being put into operation, usually without any dialogue. We've seen that on this show several times. Remember that's happened with Mike a few times over the last few seasons on the show. And in this instance, we're witnessing the staging of, you know, they're basically faking a gangland style hit on Arturo and Nacho. And for the first several minutes of it, I think there isn't any dialogue until Nacho gets his second gut shot from what's his name? The guy's name? Tyrus. Who shoots him for the second time. I think Victor shoots him the first time through in the shoulder, and he gets the gut shot from Tyrus later on. So I was kind of enjoying this. It was the whole thing was very reminiscent of stuff we've seen before. Whether it be like with Mike putting something together, you knew that this was all a Gus plan to, and it's not the first time he's done something along these lines where they're staging something, for him to get to his ultimate goal of what he wants to be accomplishing here.
I
enjoyed it. It adds one more level of sympathy or empathy that we have for Nacho, because he's getting further and further into a bad situation, and with the iron, I don't know if it's irony or not, but the fact is he had done this whole thing with, you know, Don Hector to get out of the situation. And now he's probably, he might be in a worse situation to a certain extent. So, but I very much enjoyed that. And the way that the whole Nacho thing plays out through the episode, I kind of was enjoying that as well, because once again, you got to leave it to a show like Better Call Saul and the people behind it to take something, you know, the entire sequence of him being brought to the veterinarian, Dr. Caldera, and the whole process of taking care of him, whatever. This is something we've, you know, one can think of any number of movies or TV shows where we've seen that. You know, someone who's a thug or a mobster or whatever has to be taken care of by, you know, a shady doctor or someone, you know, off the books or outside of a hospital, you know, usually in a back room somewhere. You know, it's quite commonplace at this point. I love that they still found a way to make it different and fresh, and that goes back to the way it's shot, the cinematography, and the use of sound and the distortions on the soundtrack.
Yeah, really nicely done. Really, I always like when they take their time on the show, and then whenever they find interesting ways of doing stuff. Interesting, there's that word again.
Yes, it's one of those danger words for us.
We just gotta start saying fascinating, and then I can, like, you know, think it's a Star Trek reference, and then everybody's happy.
There you go. But you know, it also gave us the opportunity to see the cousins in action to a certain degree. Again, not murdering action, but just, you know, taking care of business, being methodical. It's interesting how many characters on these shows tend to be very methodical in the way they do things. You know, that's a very Gus Fring thing, and also, but anyone who works for him tends to be that way. Mike might be one of the most methodical people I've ever seen on television, and Nacho certainly is to a certain degree as well. But all this stuff with Nacho, other than making us feel sorry for him, really is there to get to Gus having that conversation with Balsa.
Yep.
And eventually getting to what his true plan really is, which is basically, you know, to eventually, because he wants to wrest control of the business for himself and not be under the cartel's thumb. And I know one of the big things was, well, one step to doing that is start using your own suppliers on, you know, on their side of the border, so to speak, and not be dependent on the cartel that way. And this was one of the ways that door is being opened, apparently. So
yeah,
that was kind
plus, of plus plus the extra side benefit, because, you know, by making this look like Mike's drug raid on them from a season or two ago, I guess that'd probably be two seasons ago, I think, but it also has the benefit of, like, you know, presumably some kind of gang type war will happen between the Salamancas and somebody not Gus's people, which,
right,
you know, just clears the playing field. So it's, you know, really smart on multiple levels, as exactly, well as it, like, you know, as well as like a fuck you to Nacho for messing up his, you know, messing his own agenda against Hector and all that. So it's just, you know, really smartly written and a good, you know, just a nice, consistent portrayal of Gus Fring and how many steps ahead he can plan at once.
Right, exactly. This is a plan that's not, a lot of plans that we tend to see tend to be, they have one motivation, one directive. His, at least in this instance especially, it's working on multiple levels. And
yeah, the natural ability of a chicken franchise manager, definitely.
Yes. And of course, one of the things this does eventually lead to, which gave probably most Breaking Bad fans a little jolt of joy, was someone that we see Gus visiting in a little chemistry lab to, you know, to check on some samples. And it turns out to be none other than Gail. I believe you were pretty happy to see Gail, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it definitely pepped me up. I just, it was one of those things where, I mean, I think we discussed it last week, you, me, and Brian, before I kicked him off the podcast again, about how the show manages to do things that, like, you don't really expect, but it makes perfect sense. So I always like a show that has the ability to surprise you in, like, a way of just like, oh, duh, of course that was going to happen. Because, I mean, we might have talked about it before, I'm not sure. I mean, if anybody has time to listen to, like, all of our podcasts about it. Maybe CJ, if you get your wheelchair stuck in an elevator, you can listen to every episode up and let us know. But I don't know if we've talked about it or not. But either way, I was surprised on Monday night, because in a very pleasant way.
Yeah, I have a strong suspicion. At one point in a previous season, we mentioned Gail as a as someone that might logically possibly show up at one point. But, you know, I don't know that for an absolute fact. And considering I made at least one or two mistakes on our previous podcast, I don't want to be held to that either, because I probably didn't. I'll get to at least one of those mistakes as we get to that part of the episode. But yeah, it's fun seeing that character again. I'm always gotten a kick out of that actor. I think his name is David Constable.
David Constable.
I don't know if that's how it's pronounced, because, you know, I can't pronounce names. Most words, but I always liked him on that, because I've seen him. I know he plays a character on the show Billions, which has been recommended to me. I haven't seen it. I don't have Showtime, so I don't care. But I've seen him on enough other things, as have you.
Right? Yeah, Damages.
His character on Damages and his character on Breaking Bad and what we see here are about as night and day as you get. I love that, you know, because he's such a friendly, meek little, you know, dork on this show.
Yeah.
And he's such a horrible, nasty, you know, well, killer on Damages. And I'm sure he's played an array of characters elsewhere, but it was really great to see him.
Yeah, we definitely like these guys that we see in supporting roles. It's always nice when we get to see them actually, like, have a little, you know, be able to show their range a bit, rather than, like, you know, back in the old days when everybody would get typecast. And so it's nice when we get to see guys have the ability to flex their muscles and show that they have that ability.
Oh, yeah, and again, it was really nice to see him. I mean, if we're going to be really... I'd say that we're unbiased about the show. We talk about the show because we like the show, whatever. But, you know, if one was going to be in any way, shape, or form negative about it, and I'm not trying to be negative about it because I loved seeing him on it. But at the same time, I would say of all the characters that we've seen pop back into the show from Breaking Bad, this is probably the one that was probably the closest they got to, like, what's the phrase you like to say all the time? Not fanboy. Fan service? Is that the phrase?
Yeah.
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 Because it wasn't absolutely necessary to have him there, because he's probably not going to be working in that laundry thing, whatever, for a few years.
No, and we've already seen a flashback scene of him and Gus setting up a super lab, but there could be stuff between that point and this point that they're still going to show. I'd like to think that this won't be the only time we see him.
Yeah, well, I guess that remains to be seen. I mean, I haven't seen if he's scheduled for any other episodes. I haven't IMDb'd it or anything. Not that they would necessarily reveal that on IMDb. Sometimes they try to keep that information, you know, off the book, so to speak. So I am unsure if this is a one-and-done kind of a situation or we will see him again.
If it's one and done, you know, it might be one of those, like, you know, a little bit of a winky, indulgent, listen to him sing, you know, it's cool to see him cameo type thing. Not, you know, not annoying, but it definitely would end up having, you know, just come. It would just feel a little bit more organic if we did see him again. Like if this is the first step to something else, or even if, you know, you'd see him again next season or something. They, you know, just kind of, you know, moving his story forward a little bit.
All right, but the flip of that is that we would not even realize that for some time.
So right.
I don't think it takes anything. I mean, except for when one does a rewatch or a binge in the future or something, one can say that. But right now, we don't know. I mean, I'm okay either way because I liked seeing him again. It felt like. It was this, but at least it's planting the seed there that we know what it's going to grow to, as opposed to like a character just like walking on that really had no business in that place in history, other than, oh, he just wanted to find a place to stick someone in there. At least it make, you can see why they would have him here, just to plant the seed for, you know, what's going to happen later on. You know, again, it's one of those things that I'm always assume the vast majority of people watching Better Call Saul watch Breaking Bad as well. So they see him, instant recognition, a smile, maybe a little sad, but for the very few people out there who haven't seen Breaking Bad, it's like, oh, just an interesting, odd, little quirky character. And they have no idea. It's like, oh, I got news for you.
Yeah, so, but yeah, it definitely, you know, it seems like, you know, it won't be the kind of thing that ends up bothering us in the long run. It's, you know, the writers of the show are smart. They're not just going to have, like, you know, Marie show up at Los Pollos and, like, steal the salt and pepper shakers before she leaves with her chicken and, like, then gonna, like, waste her time with something.
Yeah.
Even though that would be funny.
But. See, right, that would be like, okay, that's, now you're just being gratuitous about it.
Yeah.
Whereas if something had happened with a drug bust or something that was somehow connected to Gus's overall plan that somehow involved the police, and then we had what I keep thinking the most logical person that we could see show up at some point is Hank, which would be mind-blowing, but at least you could understand why he might be there. You could excuse that. Marie, like in the scenario or something like that, would be problematic.
Yeah. Well, I'm still holding out for a pre-meth Wendy more than anything else.
We are so on the same page on that one. I have been thinking season after season, we're going to see pre-crackhead Wendy. And
even if she's just like working at an A&W, which would be awesome in itself, I would be I'd be happy.
So let's see. So that's pretty much, wow, we kind of did that in nicely timely fashion. So that's pretty much the Nacho stuff. And I guess it kind of just covered the guest stuff there too. Well, we are not that Brian to slow us down. We're going.
Yeah.
Well, it's also me not doing the Act 1 through Act 5 breakdown here, so I'm trying to make this a bit more palatable for folks. And of course, if something else occurs to us about any of that stuff, we'll just bring it up anyway. We don't care. I did like the device that they used to sort of... There's a very slight, tenuous connection between all the storylines in this episode, and it is the veterinarian, the Dr. Caldera, because the moment, just before the cousins show up with Nacho, we see Jimmy McGill leaving. So
yeah,
probably we should get to the Jimmy stuff, which of course begins in the episode with him having the meeting with Mike at the diner. And this is where I made one of my dumb mistakes in our previous podcast, which I based solely on the fact I misheard something. But it doesn't matter. A mistake is a mistake. I'm not in the current political administration, I will admit, if I've made a mistake. I misheard something. I thought I heard the number 40,000 when it was 4,000. So, good Lord, the entire scheme really was just about getting one Hummel figure. And I felt extra stupid about this because it makes so much more sense, because that's so much more a Slippin' Jimmy kind of thing. The fact that they would go through all, that he'd want to go through all this trouble to basically, split 8,000 between two people. So that's, where you get the $4,000 figure from. I mean, it's a con. It's not a con, but you know what I mean. It's a fairly minor heist. Right. It's not a big safe cracking thing. It's stealing a single figure, replacing a single figurine.
Yeah, definitely not a big league move there.
Now, the scene with Mike, I loved the scene with Mike. Number one, whenever they actually do get to have these two on screen together, because it hasn't happened probably nearly as much as we would like. But it makes sense that it hasn't happened as much, because it just, they're not involved in the same world and situations as of yet. So as a result, Jimmy has no knowledge, really, of what's going on with Mike. I mean, one wonders if he ever did, but he certainly doesn't know anything about Mike's dealings with Gus and everything else. So he probably still thinks of him as, the ex-cop toll booth guy who, how could he possibly turn down a chance for $4,000? Meanwhile, that's kind of chump change to Mike right now with his deal as a security consultant?
Yeah.
for Madrigal, whatever.
Yeah. But even so, I kind of got the impression when, Jimmy told him about the $4,000, it did kind of seem like Jonathan Banks was having just enough facial thing where I got the impression that he was thinking about his granddaughter and daughter-in-law just for a second, that he was actually doing the math and trying to decide, well, I got this responsibility, but
See, I never for a second, based on the way he looked, thought he'd be interested in it. The thing I thought was interesting about his performance there, and not just the words that came out of his mouth, which I thought were fairly significant, but this may actually be, and we'll see if there's future moments on this show, but this might be one of the few times we've ever seen Mike express any sort of concern or empathy for Jimmy.
Yeah.
Because I think it's very clear by the way he's looking at him, and he does say, I'm sorry about your brother. And he says, this isn't for me, and it shouldn't be for you either. He's looking at it. He can see what's happening. And, and because he knows Jimmy from the beginning. I mean, maybe he may cut his corners and, get involved in his little shenanigans. but he's not a quote-unquote bad guy. And for him to be meeting him in a diner, you know, desperately trying to run the scheme for a Hummel figure, there's something kind of sad about that. And you know, and I think the fact he knows that his brother just passed away, at least from Mike's perspective, maybe that's what's pushing him to be acting in this manner, to suddenly have a scheme like this. And honestly, there is perhaps some degree of truth to that. You know, I mean, he certainly is, quote unquote, slipping again.
And you know, then Mike has a perspective too of, I mean, he was, you know, kind of involved in Jimmy's fucking chuckover and, you know, chicanery, the episode, because, I mean, he was, you know, skulking around the house doing stuff. So it's not something that Mike would feel guilty about, but it definitely something where, like, he would have a different perspective as to, like, you know, Jimmy's behavior and this kind of when it comes to anything to do with his brother.
Right, absolutely. So I really kind of like that, and that was,
yeah.
And I really like the measuredness of his performance, especially playing off of Odenkirk, I also find it interesting that more often than not, I always find Odenkirk and his voice to be a lot lower and raspier now than the voice that we heard him use when he was on Breaking Bad. And I wonder if that's almost just part of the eventual transformation. The fakery, so to speak, of Saul Goodman even lends itself to his voice, because if you think about it, he never sounds all that raspy, but listen to him, like, during this entire scene and other scenes as well. It's like his voice is definitely has a bit lower edge to it than we ever saw, I think, for the most part, on Better Call Saul. And it's something that literally just occurred to me during this episode, and I thought about it. And I watched a few minutes on YouTube of a Breaking Bad episode just to make sure I wasn't crazy. It's like, yeah, okay, his voice is different. It's interesting. It's just one more level to, I think, to Odenkirk's performance. Someone who probably doesn't get as much credit as he should, even though he does at least get his nominations now for the part. But
yeah.
It's really wonderful work by him as well.
Oh yeah, you know, I'm totally a fan. As we you may recall, I wanted him to be the best actor over Jon Hamm one year.
Yes, I recall we had our little.
Opinions?
Yeah, our opinion was like, you know, we both had our candidates that we were supporting. So
yeah,
the last time we had something with two really good candidates. Anyway, veer away from that. Veer away.
Right before we recorded, I watched. I picked up the first season of The Outer Limits on Blu-ray a couple months ago, and I'm slowly working my way through it with the kids when I have time before bed, because I watch, you know, spooky stuff with my kids before bed because I kind of like that. So we watched the second episode of that 100 Days of the Dragon, and like there was like so much in there that reminded me of like current political malarkey. I'm just like, ugh. I mean, you know, I don't think there's any kind of like, you know, face swapping going on. But there's definitely, you know, stuff that's just like, ugh, you know, this is 50 years old. Ugh, this doesn't feel that much different.
It's
progress.
It's fascinating when one dips 50 or 40 years ago and finds something which is eerily prescient,
yeah.
Or even just a couple years ago. I mean,
yeah.
Everything from, I'll even be able to connect to what we're talking about. Like Network, for example.
Yeah, I still have to watch that. Okay, I have it recorded.
Okay, well, you need to see that movie, and folks can read the book too. But that it's crazy how on the nose and how much it saw what was going to happen to media, the news, you know, entertainment as news, and the way people act and react to things, and it's brilliant. And
yeah, I just saw a discussion of somebody was talking about that, you know, in a film group or something on Facebook, and they were talking about how Network was kind of like a, you know, like a spiritual successor to the Billy Wilder film Ace in the Hole, which we've discussed on the podcast way back in the day. But just kind of like, you know, in the same vein of, I mean, just, you know, nothing has changed, and like, you know, I guess this is why like people are progressives, because they don't want us to like still be the same shitty people we were 60 years ago,
right? And to tie and to watch how I do this, and to tie it to the shows we're talking about, they actually have network has they've turned it into an actual stage play that was in that has been in London for a number of months and is now going to be debuting here in New York on Broadway later this year with the main character. Although I always think the other, he's not actually the main character personally. He's not. He's actually not. Howard Beale is going to be played by none other than Bryan Cranston. So
nice.
I am hoping that somehow, now that my finances are starting to get slightly better, but not really, I might still figure out a way to nab a ticket for that, because I think that would be amazing to see in person.
Yeah.
And I will wait out there. I'll wait out there for my plea bill. No, I won't do that. Maybe I will. No, I already have a signature on something. I don't need to. Anyway. So, back to Jimmy. So, he ends up going to see... That's when he goes to see Dr. Caldera. And we get to see yet another moment of Jimmy doing the sell. Wherein he gets on the phone with someone that we don't know who it is as of yet. But it's whoever he's trying to enlist in his scheme to get the Hummel figure. And basically he just gets on and asks him if does he shit gold, I think is what he keeps asking. So obviously he convinces the person on the phone. And then when the plan is put into action, and there's a moment, I was waiting to see who it was. Because first they're in silhouette, I can't really make out who they were. And then I kind of sort of saw him, and for a moment I thought, wait, is that just Odenkirk wearing a weird beard or something? And then I got a better look at him. I was like, I recognize that face. He's got it. And once I recognized the face, I'm like, he's got to be someone from Breaking Bad. And now, before they showed who it was, did you think it was going to be one of the two guys that we came to know in Breaking Bad as his usual henchman that he usually hired, the Bill Burr and the comedian, what was his character's name?
Yule.
Can't remember the actual actor's name. I thought it was going to be one of them.
Yeah, my first thought was just based on how he was going through the veterinarian is it would be one of those schlubs that didn't go on the Pimento mission with Mike and Price back in season one. I thought it'd be like, you know, either like the really big guy or, you know, I thought maybe it would be that, you know, the really big guy, not like the little Weasley dude with all the guns.
Oh, okay. I remember who you're talking about.
Yeah.
Well, I just thought this would be a spot where they could pop in a Breaking Bad character and you see like, oh, it's the beginning of their connection. Just like we saw Yule in last season. And so the guy looked familiar to me. Now I'll confess, I was like, I know who that is. I just can't think of who it is. I did have to go online. I'm not as big an expert as I thought I was. And yes, he is from Breaking Bad. That was Ira, who we came to see in season 5 of Breaking Bad as the guy who was running Vamanos Pest, the extermination service that Walt and Jesse ended up taking over. Whatever. And who, you know, who was brought to them by Saul Goodman. So, you know, this begins their connection. So,
yeah.
So we actually see the seeds of a couple different relationships that come to more fruition in Breaking Bad. Although this is clearly a much more minor one than, say, Gus and Gale.
Yeah. But, you know, it just open the possibility of, like, you know, maybe we'll see Todd sometime or something like that. Not exactly a small character or a small cameo, but still something that you theoretically could see.
Todd might be tough based on the age situation, but
yeah. I think Jesse Plemons is. I think it's he's got a kind of one of those heads that's starting to blow up a bit, but you never know. it just happens. You know, happens to all these guys. Be like, you know, not all these guys, but you know, Duchovny and some of these guys. I mean, as they age, their heads just kind of, I don't know, fill up with air. They look like Mr. Mackey on South Park after a while.
Good Lord. Anyway. So So that, well, I'll refer to the guy as Ira, since I know that's what his actual name is. So Ira's trying to steal Makoff with the Hummel figure, and it turns out that the owner of the copy store, Neff, is still there, that he's on the outs with his wife. I totally love the conversation, although we only hear one side of it, which is fantastic, that the guy has with his wife, that apparently he bought her a vacuum cleaner as a gift, which upset her, and she threw him out. What I loved about that is, like, that's like such an antiquated idea. You know, it sounds like something that you would have seen on, like, a sitcom from, like, the 50s, 60s, or 70s or something. Like, you bought me a vacuum cleaner? Ow!
Yeah, I know. I was trying to think of some way to, you know, like when he started arguing with her, I thought maybe they're going to do some, you know, cute double indemnity nod, because, I mean, they confirmed on the Insider podcast last week that they named Neff, you know, based on Fred McMurray's character in that. But no, they just, you know, did their own thing. And it definitely was funny. And I mean, this whole scene was just, you know, the funniest thing they've done for quite a while in Better Call Saul, in my opinion.
Between the phone call itself, the pizza order.
Yeah, his stomach issues, and then the pizza.
And, I mean, I know you're into this, but some of us aren't. The various pizza breads that to go along with.
Oh, yeah, dipping sticks, which, of course, we've mentioned them, Breaking Bad a couple times, and, you know, he ordered from the same place that they tend to order on there. So it was, you know, nice to see that. It definitely made me...
And he's watching or listening to, like, you know, these management training tapes, which sound like something out of the 80s or something. The whole thing I love that everything had a very antiquated feel to it, which in a way, I guess, almost makes sense, because just the idea that there's a place that their big specialty is that it's copiers. And yes, of course, copiers are still a big thing now, but there's something about it that just feels very retro to me.
Right. At some point, like, you know, pretty much every printer came up with that option. So I suppose, they're definitely, you know, they're not the greatest thing, but, you know, copiers definitely.
Well, they're still huge in every office, but every copy is also, it's a printer and a scanner or whatever. But that kind of stuff is usually handled by number one, gigantic office supply places, not a place that only specializes in copiers. And it really starts to fall under the umbrella of computer technology now. So it's whoever's handling all your other hardware is dealing with that.
Right.
There's not really, I mean, I'm not saying there aren't copier places out there, because, again, I made enough mistakes last week. But it's just not, I think there aren't, I don't think there's just that many.
I agree. It definitely, the whole thing definitely had this, like, you know, just not quite of this time feel in a funny, you know, goofy, quirky way.
Oh yeah. So
and those and the rotating, you know, copiers on the, you know, the rotating pedestals. That's definitely like something you'd see in the, you know, Art Deco something 40s or something.
Oh well, making such a big deal, you know, the showroom aspect of it for copiers is like, really? when Ira does get, you know, a moment, I guess maybe when he goes back to the bathroom or something, he does put out an emergency call to Jimmy. And so Jimmy does eventually get him out of there by coming up with a way to not only set off the car alarm, which doesn't work the first time, but actually get Neff's car rolling down the parking lot, so he has to chase after it, which was a neat little trick. I almost wish they'd shown us more details on how he did that. It's like, you show us all the other meticulous things that they do on this show, but we kind of rushed it on that one a little bit there.
Yeah.
But I don't know if we're going to get to the point of seeing someone actually selling the figure, you know, at whatever convention or auction or however they're going to do that. I'm going to say they probably won't do that, because I think that feels like it would just eat up way too much time for something rather innocuous. Yeah. Then again, this is also the show that they spent, you know, a good minute and a half or 2 minutes giving us a little slice and backstory of a guy who Mike steals the badge of a couple weeks ago. So I wouldn't put anything past these guys.
No. And I do kind of like how, I mean, even though how like the, you know, Neff didn't really care about the, you know, the wall of trophies and Hummels, et cetera. I still like that they, you know, took the time to switch out the figure with a different, you know, with a cheap ass generic one instead, just, you know, just in case, a little extra layer of stuff, which maybe Jimmy wouldn't have bothered doing if Mike hadn't, you know, told him to, like, well, you know, you were just at this place, you know, you sure you want to be involved in this, so on, so.
Right. So while the stuff with Jimmy is going on, we should then switch over to his bet, even though they're not married, she's still his better half, Kim. Kim goes to see the people at Mesa Verde, the bank. And apparently she's hired a new paralegal to help her, Viola. Viola, she had a really simple last name. Did I write it down? It's like Viola Gott, or not Gott. You know, it might have been. I'm just seeing. I think I wrote it down here. Did I write it down? Kim Viola. Go to? Doesn't matter. Her name is Viola. Doesn't matter. So we go with Kim to Mesa Verde, and she's meeting with the main woman there, whose name escapes me right now. But the key moment is when the other fellow, the guy in charge, comes in and wants to show her the models. And she's taken into this room, and I love that that they went through all this trouble to have, you know, speaking of like the copiers on their little in their little showroom like this, you know, these like each model on a separate little pillar, you know, all, you know, beautifully lit. You know, of all the different new bank branches that they would open, you know, in several different towns and in different states, you know, from Utah to Portland and so on, whatever. And we're watching the scene, and they have the soundtrack starts to play up, you know, reflecting, you know, what's going on in Kim's mind, to the point where it pretty much makes what he's saying virtually inaudible. Like, you can't really tell what he's saying. And it was kind of a set. It was one of a couple really sad moments for Kim, I thought, in the episode. Because I'm thinking, like, is this what my life is going to be? Is this really what I want to be doing? That was my initial interpretation of it. You know?
Yeah, I think there might be some, like, you know, her seeing this massive expansion and the, you know, knowing that the respect that she's gotten from him, you know, assuming that she'd have, you know, there would be a lot of work, so she might have, you know, like a little bit of, like, you know, potential overwork PTSD going on at the moment. There's just a lot of different stuff going on.
Well, there's And speaking to that, there's a moment when, and I think they go in for a little bit of a close-up of her, when she's looking through one of the model banks. And, of course, the way it's framed, it looks like she's behind bars, like she's caged or trapped. And so going with what you're saying, like, it's kind of like, oh, she's trapped in this situation where she's going to be, you know, having to go through all this and deal with this, you know. Is this what she became a lawyer for? Is this really what she wants to do? Is how I was reading it. So it'll be curious to see how that plays out beyond this. The fact that she decided she didn't want to write the draft after all, you know, that alone kind of, I felt, was kind of underscoring that, perhaps.
Yeah, and it's kind of sad, too. I mean, she, you know, she's been through some shit, and this doesn't seem like the worst gig in the world. I mean, you know, the work she's doing is, you know, honest and, you know, not like, you know, screwing anybody over, and she's, you know, quite good at it. So it's, you know, it's sad that she's not able to just enjoy, like, you know, her potentially, like, rapidly escalating position in this company that's certainly trying to grow. Well,
I think number one, to a certain extent, that it's always going to be somewhat tainted by how she, you know, was able to land or keep the account. What happened with HHM and with Chuck McGill and all that, you know, even if she, either one, and whether she truly was or not, one can imagine, at least in her own mind, she feels somewhat complicit.
Yeah.
To whatever degree. And the fact that Chuck is now dead, she may even, to whatever, even perhaps a smaller degree, she may even feel complicit in that as well. Because that what happened with him and involving the Miss Virgin, that was all a contributing factor to his eventual downfall, and in her mind, probably what would have led to him killing himself. Whether that's true or not, one can never know, but it's a very direct and clear theory, you know, or way to look at it, I think. And that's certainly the way I would look at it. I know that. So this eventually gets us to a scene with Jimmy and Kim later on. And I did watch the scene more than once. And I would recommend anyone who watched it the first time, watch it one more time. If you still have it in your DVR, watch it a second time. But this time, because I think when you watch it the first time, the focus is we're listening to what he's saying. We're listening to Jimmy read the letter. She finally gives him the letter that Chuck had left for him, as well as, you know, him signing off on the $5,000, blah, blah, blah. And I think when you watch it the first time, the whole thing is about you wanting to hear what he says. So if you're focusing on anything at all in the scene, at least for the first two thirds of that reading of that letter, we're focusing on Jimmy. My recommendation, because I did this, watch it the second time, just keep your eyes on her. I'm talking about before they switch the shot where the shot eventually focuses on her. But before that, when it's a two shot, watch her, and then if you didn't know it before, then you realize why we go on and on about how much we love Rhea Seehorn and her performance on this show. One of the greatest things about that actors do and talk about when they're in a performance, it's all about listening and taking information and whatever, and watching how she's listening and watching Jimmy with every word he's saying, and realize, and because when you watch her the whole time, you can also see that the fact that she does get very emotional, that she's tearing up and that she has to, you know, needs a minute, is not purely based on the words that Chuck said. It is it's about the way Jimmy is still acting and treating this.
He's pretty much not Jimmy. He's just, you know, Saul now. And that side of him has not been something she's been a fan of in the past. And so now that he has it on all the time, and even at a moment like this when he should be, like, you know, maybe vulnerable, it's just, you know, he's not lowering his guard down at all. And I'm sure that's probably, you know, scary and not a good thing for her to see, as well as, you know, with the content of the letter itself isn't, you know, super cheery.
Right. I mean, I think in her mind, and I believe this is still true for his character, at least at this point, is he's a master of compartmentalization. And he's pretty much taken, you know, the emotional impact of stuff with his brother and, you know, locked it in a box and put it away somewhere. And a lot of that is probably based on Chuck's last words to him, which were pretty brutal, which were on the heels of other pretty brutal things that Chuck had done and said to him as well. And while Jimmy did some pretty lousy things too, which obviously led to Chuck's downfall at the law firm, yada, 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 but the stuff that Chuck did and said really went back to their entire relationship, over the entire history of their relationship. And I genuinely do feel that when Howard had that admission of, you know, pseudo guilt in the premiere, that pretty much was what, you know, locked the box, so to speak, because it gave Jimmy a way out. It was like, okay, you know what? This isn't on me. This was you. You'll have to live with that. I'm fine, because, you know, he already wrote me out of his life. Why should I spend another moment giving a flying fig about him at this point. And now, whether he's just, in an intense form of denial, which may lead to some sort of breakdown at some point later this season, or whether he's just, this is the path he's taken and he's not going to diverge from it, remains to be seen. I don't think he's crossed into Saul Goodman land just yet. Obviously, all these things are, pushing him closer to that. But I think we still got a ways to go on the show. I think we will see moments where his true humanity will come out again. But I think right now he's, in the time that we've seen him since the end of that first episode, this is he's gone into slipping Jimmy mode, totally. We haven't seen the other side of him yet. And even though he had a moment of trying, like when he went for the job interview, the Jimmy mode, the slipping Jimmy came back to him. And maybe it was when he saw the humble thing, or maybe when he just realized, this isn't for me. I can't just be a 9-to-5 guy. I can't just, there's always, what's the excitement? What's the thrill? What's the challenge here? As we talked about, in a previous podcast. But again, they've had a habit of, having these really intense, great scenes with either one or the other, either Kim or Jimmy or the two of them together, towards the end of, each of these episodes. And I really love the staging of the moment that ends the episode when she walks, when she goes into the other room and he tries to come after her. And she, she doesn't shut the door on him. But the door does swing almost closed. And the way it ends with it kind of like splitting his face that way. I thought that was really a nice shot to end on. And of course, you can read any number of things into, him standing in a doorway and what it leads to, him being split in half, and whether this is which half of him that we're looking at, all that kind of stuff. They clearly were thinking of all those things when they put that shot together, I thought.
Oh yeah, totally.
Trying to think if there was anything else that stood out to you, or something that we kind of skipped by that merits a few words here, while I try to sift through my scrolls.
The car that they have Nacho say was the one that shot him up.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's something we've seen before. Do you have any idea if that's something we might have seen in Breaking Bad, or if it's just like they're gonna set up, we'll see whoever drives that next episode and then they'll shoot them up or something.
He said it was a silver car. I think that was the only thing he said.
Firebird or something.
Yeah, it might have been a Firebird, right? I don't remember it.
Yeah, me neither.
So my assumption is it'll be something that we'll see later, but it's not something that we've seen before. But again, could be wrong.
I think you only make mistakes when Brian's around and you're worried that he's going to kick you off the podcast, which is enough to throw anybody off their A game, to be sure.
Yeah. Well, I gotta be nice to Brian. I was actually listening to another podcast earlier today while I was working, which is a rarity, but there's only a short series of them, and they're so short I don't mind. And Brian actually was a guest on one of the two episodes I listened to, and he did a nice name drop for me in a complimentary fashion. It's like,
Nice. Yeah, I probably should. Yeah.
Unlike other people connected to that podcast, he actually remembers my name. But
I should, well, whatever. It's got Eric. I think that
son of a bitch.
Yeah, I think I should be nice to Brian too, because at some point I probably will be on death row, and I seriously might need him to file some kind of appeal paperwork or something, or maybe smuggle a file into the jail with his sweet ass beard. I don't know, something, but I probably should but walk back some of this criticism a little bit that I'm spewing. But it's all jealousy anyway, because he's definitely smoother than me, and he's got that sweet, Southern voice without like the negative attitude and the like assuming that the war was about states' rights and other foolishness.
Oh, what did you actually think of the letter from Chuck, by the way? I never even
No, it was nicely done. I mean, it was kind of like I wouldn't say I was like on the edge of my seat, expecting like to be something major in there, but it was definitely like, you know, close to that thing where I'm just like, oh, you know, how's this going to end? But at the end, the letter ended up being, not the thing. It was more about the way, you know, the way that Jimmy was reading it and Kim was reacting to it in the end.
How long? One gathers from the content of the letter that this was something he wrote back when Jimmy was still in the mailroom.
Yeah, you're in the mailroom. You're good at this. Definitely pre-American Samoa legal jiggery.
Which makes me go, wow, he decides to write a letter in case he dies that long ago?
I suppose it could have been like at the beginning of his electromagnetic psychosis where like, you know, maybe he thought like it was like, you know, serious shit and it was going to progress. So maybe that's when he started doing it.
Yeah, that actually makes sense. I love his deadpan reaction to the 5,000. Like, oh, I can pay off my MasterCard, and I was thinking, wow, that would even cover half of my MasterCard. Oh, actually, it wouldn't. That's true. I'm just sifting through, trying to read what the hell I wrote. You know, it's not easy with the puffy eye here, but I think that was pretty much everything about the episode.
Yeah, I think we covered it, but I definitely was impressed with it. You know, another solid Gordon Smith episode, and they definitely managed to have a nice balance between the the cool, brutal gang stuff and the genuinely funny caper stuff, and then the emotional crap we're going through.
Right.
You know, with Kim and everybody, there wasn't a ton of Mike, but a lot of the characters had plenty of room to do stuff in this episode.
Yeah, how many episodes of any TV show can one think of where you have two plans or plots that, you know, one as dark and as light as you get on the other, you know, one is staging or, you know, staging a murder scene, you know, and making sure one of the people is, you know, has been shot a couple times to make it look like he was, you know, he's and he almost dies, and the other one is stealing a Hummel figure.
Yeah.
I really did get a kick out of that the more I thought about it. It's another excellent episode of the show. I think I love the fact that I still, the thing about the show is like, with a show with all these characters and we know where they lead to in Breaking Bad, as I've said in previous podcasts, I'm still not sure where it's going to go for this season. At least as far as Jimmy is concerned. One can kind of surmise what they'll get to between season to season as far as Gus stuff is concerned. And then but not Jimmy. Yeah. Jimmy's more of the mystery here, I think.
Right. Yeah. They're in the position where they have, you know, they have a little bit more runway, since they know they have another season after this. So I think that might maybe, you know, they might, you know, draw out the story a little bit different way. I mean, just kind of like, you know, let stuff just kind of, you know, flow into the next season, and, you know, they might do things a little bit differently than they've done before this point.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I still think they're at this point, they're not going to be inclined to do any kind of major time jump, but who knows? They haven't so far. This is all feels like all three plus seasons now. I guess three and a third have all taken place pretty one right after the other. I don't think there was a brick of time in between, but I'm not really. My mind's not what it used to be, so maybe I'm forgetting something. Also, it's funny when you start bringing in all these Breaking Bad characters, especially in this episode, you start realizing. Especially if you're like a hardcore Breaking Bad fan, the way we are, you're like, hey, we're watching a show with a lot of eventually going to be dead people.
Yeah.
It's like, I know how you're going to die and you're going to die. And I think this one is like at least five or six. It might be like six different characters. Like, yeah, I'm going to see each one of you die eventually on Breaking Bad. I think six of them. I don't think we ever see Ira die, but I think there's six other characters, you know. Actually, let me think. Gus, Victor, Tyrus, Mike, obviously, spoiler, Gale, and Bulsa gets killed. So,
yes,
that's six.
Yeah.
That is a lot, actually, when I think about it. All right. So, hey, look at that. Without that attorney around, we were able to get done in an hour. He's what's been padding this.
Long-winded goofball. Yeah, totally.
Anyway, I'm sure he'll return for a future podcast. If there's one that deals with like real legal matters, we definitely want to get him on board for that.
Right. Yeah. I just gotta say that I kind of hope the show does something really ridiculous, like they have an episode just filled with like the most intense like Breaking Bad like gang violence, and then the next episode is called like a 12 pack of mini buns, and it's just a Gene like a totally Gene episode the entire time. It's just Gene doing stuff.
I would love it, but I just don't think that.
No, they probably won't, but it would be funny.
But it would be great. I would love it. I wish they could just have like little Gene webisodes up on somewhere.
Yeah. All
right. So, if you enjoyed this podcast, people, then you probably enjoy hanging out on our Facebook page as well. It's the Serious TV Drama podcast page. You can find it on Facebook. Like the page and join the conversation about shows like Better Call Saul and so many others. There's been a weird phenomenon on the page just in the last week, which is, I find, highly disturbing. I don't know if like every person I know who is on that page suddenly blocked the page or something. Because usually when you post something there, you'll see that it's been seen by 22 people, it's been seen by 33 people, it's been by 45 or 50 or 70 or 100, whatever. And lately I've been posting things and I go back and look like this. It's like seen by 3 people. It's like, that's not even possible. Is there something going wrong with the Facebook, yet another Facebook algorithm? Because I think in one instance, it can't be true because there's more people who commented on something than have seen the post in the first place, which doesn't make any sense. It's just one more way of the technology pissing me off. I don't know why I went off on that rant. Sorry. Anyway, it was just bothering because I posted our last podcast and like a couple days later, it was like seen by 3. And it was like, what? And there actually may be rants on that page every once in a while. Who knows? You can also find us on iTunes. It's Serious TV Drama Podcast. You can subscribe to our feed there as well as rate and review us. You can just simply Google us. You can find us in a number of other places. Turns out we're on YouTube more than half the time, except in certain countries. And what else? Oh, Twitter. You can also follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is at STVD Podcast. It's STVD as in Serious TV Drama Podcast. All right. We will be back next week. Probably we'll get it done the same day. It depends on our schedules, whatever.
I'm not sure if I'll be able to do it Monday. I'm taking the kids to the Minnesota State Fair that day, and when I'm leaving home at like 5 a.m, so we can get there early enough to park.
Then we'll try to shoot. Well, then we'll probably more likely shoot for a Wednesday again, whenever we both have free. The kids out there don't want to hear that. Anyway, that's pretty much it. I can't think of anything else. So, call it a night. All right, great talking to you. Have a good night, Dan, and good night to everybody out there.
Yep. Good night, Meow.
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, protactinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine, and thorium, and thulium, and thallium. There's yttrium, ytterbium, actinium, rubidium, and boron, gadolinium, niobium, iridium, and strontium, and silicon, and silver, and samarium, and bismuth, bromine, lithium, beryllium, and barium. There's holmium and helium and hafnium and erbium and phosphorus and francium and fluorine and terbium and manganese and mercury, molybdenum, magnesium, dysprosium and scandium and cerium and cesium and lead, praseodymium and platinum, plutonium, palladium, promethium, potassium, polonium and tantalum, technetium, titanium, tellurium and cadmium and calcium and chromium and curium. There's sulfur, californium, and fermium, berkelium, and also mendelevium, einsteinium, nobelium, and argon, kryptonium, radon, xenon, zinc, and rhodium, and chlorine, carbon, cobalt, copper, tungsten, tin, and sodium. These are the only ones of which the news has come to Harvard. And there may be many others, but they haven't been discovered.